Good morning and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Dollars and Making Sense. I'm Ray Trevisan from OTG Capital. Always a pleasure to have your company. Now, this week, we welcome back to the microphone Philippa Hunt from Wise Girls Money. And this week, we're going to be talking about an Alan Kohler piece that he wrote in the New Daily that pertains to the Levy submission to the finance department. Now, you're going to sit there and listen to all of this and go, God, why is that of any interest to me? Well, let me tell you why. Is because the advice industry is in crisis at the moment, ladies and gentlemen. It's one of those things that, in amongst all the news that's out there right now, this is getting drowned out and nobody really has any idea or clue why or who or the therefore. And therefore, I guess at the end of the day, we're doing this to raise a bit of awareness that the number of financial advisors out there 3 years ago was close to 30-odd thousand. It's down around 15 or so thousand now. Why have they all left? Because it's incredibly hard to keep a business running in financial planning and advice these days. The change of regulation, the overburden of paperwork that's required now, and it's just increased the costs so much that most people are looking at it and going, you've got to be joking, I'm not going to pay $5,000 for a financial plan. And much of this, I think, is by design. And I'm discussing with Philippa today Alan Kohler's discussion about the consultation paper that is before Treasury at the moment and the reasons why we're at this point that we're now at. And so looking at all the things that are happening, why is this of interest? Is because so many people are now retiring and need financial advice but have no idea where to go and whether they can actually even afford it. And so I guess we're going to work through a number of these facets. So without further ado, we'll go to a short station announcement. You're here on Dollars and Making Sense. I'm Ray Trevisan from OTG Capital, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, and thank you for listening. This is Phil Osborne with Philippa Hunt and Ray Trevisan presenting Dollars and Making Sense, a weekly radio program about finance, money, and investing. Broadcasting from Radio Northern Beaches on 88.7 and 90.3 megahertz on the FM band every Tuesday morning from 8 a.m. The program is also streamed on the internet at www.rnb.org.au and on your favourite podcast platform.
And good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Dollars and Making Sense. Always a pleasure to have your company, and I'm really pleased to have somebody new at the microphone today. I have Alicia Peevely from Sophie Grace. Now, who is Sophie Grace? Sophie Grace are compliance and legal specialists. Now, the reason I wanted Sophie Grace to come along to chat to us, and I've got to be careful I don't refer to Alicia as Sophie, so there is a real Sophie Grace, isn't there?
There is. Sophie is our director.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I'm talking to our general manager today of Sophie Grace, who's not Sophie, but is Alicia. So if you're confused, don't worry. I got confused as well. But anyway, look, Sophie Grace is a compliance and legal specialist firm who deals with something that's very near and dear to my heart in compliance and regulatory. Now, it's near and dear to my heart because I actually had ASIC knock on my door earlier this year and say, we need to have morning tea with you, Ray, because you haven't been doing the right thing. And we found out that our Google AdWords weren't doing the right thing. And so we fixed it up pretty quickly. And within 4 days, actually, ASIC gave us the all clear. And that was kind of nice. But I thought it would be very good to have somebody that really specializes in this area on the show. And I've got a whole bunch of really good questions. So first of all, Alicia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. And I'm so pleased that you did say yes, because I felt there was a bit of reticence at first, sort of going, oh, I don't know about going on a radio show and, you know, you're going to be recording this and am I going to be held to it? Well, actually, yes, we are recording. And yes, I will hold you to what we talk about today, but for good reason, because I think, and given that you're out there dealing with industry professionals, I'm dealing with consumers. And even though my fund is wholesale and they're sophisticated investors, not everyone is sophisticated. and so when you're dealing with Joe Public and Madam Public, I think it's a very different conversation we end up having than, you know, in the industry itself, don't you find?
I think that's true, definitely.
So what I'd like to do to kick the show off, I guess, Sophie, is tell the audience a little bit about yourself, how you came to Sophie Grace, and a bit about your background.
Yeah, sure. So I've been with Sophie Grace since 2012.
10 years.
Yes, yes.
Congratulations.
Go quickly when you're having fun. Thank you. Yeah, I did a law degree at university and originally wanted to actually be a criminal lawyer. But Sophie offered me the role at Sophie Grace. And I think once I started, I realized just how challenging and diverse the financial services industry is. It's complex and it's ever changing. It's really a great place to work, and we deal with lots of different clients. It's incredibly diverse, really. That's sort of the summary of me.
I must say it is fascinating because my daughter's godfather is a criminal lawyer, and some of the stories that we heard over barbecues and no names mentioned, no prisoners taken, etc. But I think you dodged the virtual and the real bullet, quite frankly, Alicia, because dealing in the criminal law space, although I've got to say some of the people that I've met on a day-to-day basis in the financial services industry skirt the law pretty close. And although they will put their hands up and say, well, we're not criminals. And I'm looking at them going, listen, I guess it comes about, and it's quite topical when we talk about what's legal, but what is within the general intent and good standing. And, it's so topical at the moment because we've had, a big scandal in federal politics where somebody was said to have done something legal, but ... And so I guess when we're talking about ambiguity, being a lawyer, I mean, that's your stock and trade, isn't it? Ambiguity?
Very much so. That's a question we get asked all the time from clients is that something that's unlawful and that I really can't do? Or is there a way that we can still do this but be compliant at the same time? So that's really where we're trying to assist clients comply with the law, but also, be able to be, to be innovative in their business and really pushing the boundaries of what can be done in terms of providing financial services.
It's a strange thing for me. And because I'm a licensee, I've over the past year, I've said no so often to people now that want to become authorized representatives under our license because I look at what they're trying to do, and the first thing they say, but it's legal, and I say, listen, there's legality, and then there's legality, and I always look at the purpose and intent as well. And one of the things that I've written about a lot and spoken on the show a lot about is that if it's too good to be true, it often isn't. And that, I think when people are skirting the law, they know that they're skirting the law. Don't you find that that's the case? You're sitting in your boardroom now whilst we're recording this interview. There must be many. I'd love to be a fly on the wall when you're sitting with your clients and they're looking at you sideways going, well, look, it's legal. And you're sort of sitting there going, yeah, but, do you have those conversations a lot?
We do have them a lot. And I think I always come back to, It's all well and good to say it's legal and try and skirt the law, but what happens if, like you've had, Ray, ASIC comes knocking on your door? What do you do at that stage to show evidence that what you're doing is not just lawful but compliant and for certain types of licensees in the best interest of your client? We're seeing ASIC actively engage with industry in this way, wanting to investigate and wanting to have those conversations about conduct that they might have seen or things online that they've come across. So there's certainly a lot of enforcement happening at the moment. I think you've got to protect yourself against that. But then I'm a lawyer, so I err on the side of being very conservative.
I know so many good lawyer jokes about bottom dwellers and the like, and I'm not going to engage in those today, let me assure you, Alicia, because some of them are funny, I've got to say. They are funny, but I won't engage in those. But look, I think you make a good point. Look, one of the things that we've all noticed in the industry, and punters and general public won't necessarily notice this, but ASIC have been doing a lot more in the last couple of years in regards to compliance and policing, wouldn't you find?
Absolutely. I think in the wake of the Hayne Royal Commission in 2019, ASIC really stepped up its enforcement activities. They took this why not litigate stance, basically meaning that ASIC would increase and accelerate the court-based enforcement, so using the full extent of its powers and the penalties that were available. They have since wound that why not litigate stance back somewhat with the appointment of the new chairman, Joseph Longo. And there's a focus now with their new corporate plan on economic recovery. So we do see a little bit of a shift, but they are certainly still targeting regulatory enforcement action, specifically to those areas of greatest harm. So it's certainly not something that we can ignore.
Well, I'm going to get to one of those areas a bit later on in the show, because it's one of my topics I absolutely want to talk to you about in around crypto and NFTs and the like. But one of the factors that's, again, people that don't understand the laws and regulations, there's a lot of regulatory and compliance work being done in the SMSF sector at the moment. But a lot of people get confused because SMSFs are not actually regulated by ASIC. They're actually regulated by the tax office. And again, I know this from personal experience because they knocked on my door for that as well. But I was actually wrong in that instance and can claim malfeasance from my accountant. But it's one of those great learning experiences that one has. And I think at last count, there's something like 800,000 self-managed super funds in Australia now. It's a staggering number and probably close to $1 trillion under management now under SMSFs. And so when people talk about an overzealous regulator or an overzealous ATO, it's like, guys, there's a lot of money at stake here. And I think it's worthwhile having a diligent regulator. Now, I was going to ask you, you know, given that you are in that legal profession, what's your relationship like with ASIC?
We have a good relationship with ASIC, I would say. We deal with them a lot in terms of licensing. Mm-hmm. So we assist industry players to obtain an AFSL or a credit license. So we know the credit licensing and financial services licensing teams quite well. We're dealing with them on a day-to-day basis. But then in terms of that ongoing enforcement as well, we've assisted clients in the past to respond to ASIC's questions or investigations. And so we have a good working knowledge of what they're looking for and how to respond in a way that will address ASIC's concerns rather than raise more concerns, which I think is always the goal.
Well, I don't disagree, having been there myself. But I must add, though, I find them to be absolutely wonderful human beings. And this is the thing that people forget sometimes. They're humans just like you and I. And I think certainly in the approach that simply says, listen, if there's been a misunderstanding and an honest mistake, the people on the other end of the line, I got to tell you from my own experience, they've been wonderful. Do you find the same?
Yeah, there's certainly a couple of analysts that we just have really great relationships with, and they're happy to answer questions and try and help and give as much guidance as they can. Obviously, there will be times when they say, look, these are what the rules are and we've got to stick to them. But in many cases, we've called up analysts and sort of said, look, what are you really looking for here? Where's the concern? And they've come back to us with some helpful tips that we can pass on to clients. So, yeah, absolutely. Remembering that there's a person on the end of that, and in many cases they're happy to have a conversation and work through things is very valuable.
Yeah, and I guess in this modern day, I'm an old school kind of guy. I grew up with phones rather than mobiles and texting. Sometimes I say to people, pick up the phone and talk to another human being. It's amazing what can happen.
Yes, I say that all the time to our staff. Get on the phone and talk to the analyst. Work out what they're really looking for.
Can't I just send them an email? Or it's like, no, pick up the phone. You know, that's the way humans interact. They talk to you. I talk, you talk. We have a conversation. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a great time for us to take a station break right now. We'll go for a short station announcement. You're here on Dollars and Making Sense. I'm Ray Trevison from OTG Capital, and I'm really pleased to have at the microphone Alicia Peverley from Sophie Grace, who are specialists in compliance and legals, and we'll be back in just a moment. Thanks for listening to Dollars and Making Sense, a weekly program about finance, money, and investing. If you'd like to hear this show again, our program is repeated on Radio Northern Beaches, broadcasting on 88.7 and 90.3 megahertz on the FM band. Our programming schedule can be found on the internet at rnb.org.au. You can also stream and download our show as a podcast. Please search for Dollars and Making Sense in your favourite podcast platform or check out our blog at otgcapital.com.au/blog and our social media links on our homepage. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Dollars and Making Sense. I'm Ray Trevison from OTG Capital. I'm really pleased to have at the microphone today Alicia Peverley from Sophie Grace. Who are Sophie Grace? Sophie Grace are compliance and legal specialists in the financial services industry, and they help companies work out what they need to do to comply to ASIC's rules and make sure that they're doing the right thing. So, Alicia, welcome back. Now, before we went to the break, we were talking about, ASIC and the fact that they are human beings, and sometimes, you know, I've certainly come across really great people, but the odd occasional overzealous person. I'm just wondering, given that you've actually been at Sophie Grace now for 10 years, when you first started, do you think that regulation is easier now or harder now than when you first started?
I think overall it's harder. So when I first started at Sophie Grace, we were seeing the introduction of the FOFA regime.
Can you explain to the listeners what FOFA is, please?
Of course. So the Future of Financial Advice regime was introduced in relation to financial advisors. So it introduced a number of new duties in relation to acting in the best interests of your clients, avoiding conflicts of interest. There was a ban on conflicted remuneration that was introduced, and also certain fee disclosures and opt-in requirements for licensees to send to clients on a regular basis, making sure that the client was getting the service that they had paid for.
Fairly basic stuff, eh?
Yes, very basic stuff.
You'd expect your financial advisor would be acting in your best interests, wouldn't you? And I dare speak, you know, slightly political, but the next mob that came in when FOFA came in and watered that bit down. And I scratched my head and going, why are we saying to the financial industry we don't really care about interests of the poor old consumer? But I digress. Please continue.
Yes, FOFA was all, it was a bit all over the place, really, with all the changes of government. But, I mean, since then, we've also seen the introduction of additional financial services, so things like claims handling and settling, the limited AFSL that was introduced for accountants in order to provide certain advisory services.
And hasn't that been a roaring success?
Wow. Yes, nobody could say that, right? Could we?
I'm trying to, that dot, 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 sarcasm alert. Sorry. We're on a video feed here, ladies and gentlemen, but Alicia's smiling at me right now. That was a sarcasm alert. Sorry. I do apologize. I wasn't obvious enough.
And then also the introduction of the financial advisor standards. So, again, this change in the education requirements, the professional develop requirements, and the conduct requirements for financial planners. And even just in the last week, we've seen that there's additional consultation in relation to these standards, again, under the new government. So all of that's been changing. For financial advisors, we've also seen the introduction of ASIC's product intervention powers, which they've used in relation to contracts for difference and also some credit products. I think out of the Hayne Royal Commission, there's been a lot that's been introduced, particularly in 2021. There are a lot of reforms that came in October 2021. So we saw reform in the breaches regime, requiring licensees to report, frankly, a lot more to ASIC. And we've seen reform in relation to complaints management, the tightening of timeframes to respond to complaints. We've also seen the introduction of the design and distribution regime, which requires certain licensees to identify and assess their target market and produce additional disclosure documentation.
I know that one as well.
It goes on and on, really, in terms of the new regulation. And I think it becomes more complex. It becomes more time-consuming for those risk and compliance employees within licensees. But then if you're a small licensee, you could be a one-man band. So for you to get your head around as a sole trader licensee, the number of different changes, whether they apply to you, and then how to implement robust procedures to actually ensure that you're complying on an ongoing basis. It's time consuming, it's costly. I think we can see that just looking at the change in the breach regime. There's significantly more work involved to identify and investigate and report breaches to ASIC than there were 10 years ago. So the cost of creating all of that is high.
Yeah, and I've got to say, as a practitioner myself, I wholeheartedly agree with you, Alicia, because I guess one of the things that I'm always I go the extra mile, kilometre, metricated, whatever, but I go that extra distance to ensure when I sign a client up in my investment fund that they fully understand what they're doing, even though I operate in a space that says wholesale and sophisticated. And, you know, when I talk about the Wild West, that is the Wild West, because the corporations law that surrounds the sophisticated and wholesale investor sphere is pretty loose. And I was at a conference just recently at the beginning of the year that, given the rise of real estate prices so dramatically in the past 2 to 3 years, something like 40 to 45% of the nation now qualifies to be sophisticated or a wholesale investor. Now, when the rules came out, and this goes 20 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, you know, $2.5 million 20 years ago was a sizable chunk of change. In Sydney, people sort of look sideways and go, oh, gosh, that's a two-bedroom bungalow out the back of nowhere. And so all of a sudden, a lot more people can qualify in a sphere where I really believe, and I'm saying something now that would hurt my own business, but there are too many people that I've encountered that don't read their documents. They don't read the information memorandum, or they don't read the product disclosure statement. And even if you provide a good version or a cut down version, I try and make sure that they fully understand what they're signing. But I know there are too many people out there as well that are more than happy to have the 40-page document because they know it's not going to get read, and they happily sign the customer up and take their cash and invest away. So in your day-to-day work, I guess, Alicia, one of the reasons that I came across you and your company was that we started getting finfluencers coming to us. And so when we're talking about over-regulation, here's a place where one of my other contributors, Philippa Hunt, is an ex-financial planner, and she and I were talking about finfluencers earlier this year. And so when all these finfluencers got invited for morning tea by ASIC, something happened. Maybe I might hand that over to you. I'll hand the microphone back to you, Alicia. Can you tell the audience what happened earlier this year when ASIC decided to have morning tea with the finfluencers?
Yes, I think they all realised they actually might be providing financial product advice.
Might or definitely were.
And trying to be, you know, politically correct. And turned around and asked, well, how do we get licensed? And a quick way is to become an authorised rep on another licensee. So we saw this influx of new client inquiries in relation to this finfluencer crackdown, if you like, with people asking, well, what's an AFSL? How do I get under one?
They didn't even know what an AFSL was.
No.
Oh, my word.
Yes. It's been an interesting time with all these inquiries. But I think, look, what we've seen is in order to obtain an AFSL, you need to have certain qualifications and experience. And Finfluencers generally, as a general rule, would not have those qualifications or experience. And so they're looking at a way to become authorised quickly to get out of ASIC's line of sight. And we have been involved in a number of them becoming authorised representatives on someone else's AFSL, which I guess has its own problems in a sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting conversation, Alicia, because you referred a few of them to us and we had some independently come to us as well. I guess a decent internet search engine will find AFSL providers out there that have CARs or corporate authorised representatives under their gamut, and my firm, Dirigir Advisory, is one of those. But very quickly, when you know my compliance expert, he has a master's degree in compliance, and believe me, what he knows, it's amazing. It's the depth of knowledge is astounding. But we within 5 minutes, you know, we said no to every single one of these applicants because we sat there and said, listen, you know, I have no doubt that you can do a great TikTok video, you know, congratulations, but regurgitating information off the Money Smart government website and sprouting financial data doesn't make you a financial expert. And when we told them the years of study and FASEA and the RG146 and all these other things, that guess what, ladies and gentlemen, we've all done that. I'm talking to a lawyer that's done 4 years of uni and Lord knows how many more hours and years of CPD to keep her stuff up to standard. That's what you expect of financial professionals. Wouldn't you agree, Alicia?
Absolutely. And I think that's what the average person who's looking at the financial information or advice that a Finfluencer is providing would expect, which is, I think, why we're seeing this crackdown from ASIC. But I think also for a licensee who's looking to take on a representative that is a Finfluencer, there's a level of risk that your license is exposed to that
wow.
I would imagine most licensees are not willing to take.
Well, we took one look at it and just walked. We showed them the door so fast and they complained and said, but. And I said, listen, you don't even have a bachelor's degree in basic economics, let alone any kind of standing in the financial community. I said, just because you can stand in front of an iPhone and do a jig, good for you, you know, welcome to the world, but I'm sorry, that doesn't qualify you to be able to give financial advice. And they argued vociferously, oh, we're not giving financial advice. And I said, well, that's not the way we see it, and that's certainly not the way the regulator sees it as well. And so I think we had this, I use this term, I guess, old school, but a coming to Jesus, a meeting of the maker time. And they were fairly harsh, weren't they? They didn't give them any sort of leeway. They shut them down pretty promptly, didn't they?
They did. There wasn't a lot of time. There wasn't a lot of warning, really. And I think that's why so many licensees such as yourself, Ray, and providers like us got this influx of calls.
I guess we the sales guy in me, I always follow up, and we said no to a few people, and so I went back 4-6 weeks later. My CRM system pops up and says, hey Ray, go back and talk to these people, see what they're doing. And I guess to my dismay, they did find a home eventually. A couple of them found homes, and having checked out, you know, how they're promoting their message and the kind of disclaimers they're putting out there, I say to them, good luck. If you get found out, I'm glad I have nothing to do with you, because when you get found out, and it's not a case of if, but when you get found out, you're going to go down again. And ASIC, I don't think, will be quite so polite this time around, because, you know, using somebody else's license is all well and good, but they've used these terms, marketing affiliation. And I might ask you, has that term come across your desk at all, marketing affiliation to promote financial products?
Not at this stage. No, it's not something I've seen. But then I think our clients who hold licenses are probably fairly conservative, much like you. I think, you know, ASIC really has this, when they're talking about marketing your product or your services, they're really wanting to see this balanced approach. And so simply just putting up the disclaimer or the risk warning page isn't sufficient. You really need to to consider your target audience and look at the actual information and advice that you're putting out there for retail clients to access. And so for licensees, trying to supervise that and monitor what a finfluencer on your license is actually doing is incredibly difficult and hard to police. And it's, you know, in the end, it's your license at risk.
And I've got to say, as a general blanket statement, they didn't take kindly to feedback and outright criticism, because I think I'm far less polite than probably you are, Alicia. I came straight out and told a few of them that it was just straight up bollocks what they were trying to do, and the gig's up. You know, you've been found out and you've been found wanting. So have a nice day, but you know, you're out of here. Anyway, on that note, let's take it's time for a short break again. You're here on Dollars and Making Sense. I'm really pleased to have at the microphone Alicia Peevely from Sophie Grace. We're talking about compliance and legality around financial services licensing and authorized representatives. And it's darn important, listeners. It really is. Even though it might sound a bit dry, we're not dry though, are we, Alicia? We're not dry at all. Not at all. Not at all. Although you did call me conservative about 5 minutes ago. I don't know how I'm going to take that one, but we'll come back. We'll come back in just a moment. You're here on Dollars Making Sense. We're going to have a short station announcement.
Thanks for listening to Dollars and Making Sense, a weekly program about finance, money and investing. Please tell us what you think. If you like or hate what you're hearing, get in touch with us. We also welcome any questions about finance, investing, budgeting and anything money related that you might be interested in. You can get in touch with us via our blog, social media channels or email. We welcome all levels of investors across all disciplines of investing and asset classes. Our program is all about education, no matter if you are a raw beginner or a seasoned investor. Phil, Ray and I look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Dollars and Making Sense. I'm Ray Trevison from OTG Capital. Always a pleasure to have your company. And today I have Alicia Peevely from Sophie Grace, and we are talking compliance and legality around financial services licensing and people that are called corporate authorized representatives. Why is that important, ladies and gentlemen? Because when you are dealing with somebody in financial products, they need to be authorized. It is illegal to sell a financial product in this country unless you are licensed. Now, Alicia, before we went to the break, we were talking about whether the pendulum has swung too far one way or the other. And you said, I guess, anecdotally, 10 years ago, that when you first started, it was probably a bit easier. It's certainly a lot harder now. I guess one of the things now, we've got a new government in town. Stephen Jones is the new financial services minister, and he made some interesting pronouncements during the election cycle, which Jane Hume matched dollar for dollar. Pound for pound, whatever anecdote you like. So I'm curious, given what we're trying to do is make a very complex environment as simple as possible for punters, is there a one-size-fits-all out there, or do we need to be still specific when we're dealing product by asset class, by client, et cetera, et cetera?
I wouldn't say there's a one-size-fits-all approach. And mainly, I mean, from my perspective, I would say that because I think it's relevant to look at the different size of licensees, their different risk factors, the different clients and products that they work with. So, for instance, some business types, say an OTC derivatives issuer, they have a very high-risk business. They're working with a high-risk product.
I'll just stop you there for a moment. Can you explain to the listeners OTC, over-the-counter?
Yes, over-the-counter derivatives issuers. So generally, they would operate a platform where you can trade derivative products. So there's no underlying asset delivered to you. You're trading on the price of the underlying asset, so say a share or a commodity. So it's a fairly risky business, and they're dealing with often retail clients who may not fully understand the risks associated with that type of trading. Where, for instance, a general insurance broker, insurance is a product that is I would say, generally well understood by everyday Australians, and they face...
That's a big assumption, isn't it?
Well, they're at least dealing with that product
on a regular basis. They hear the word a lot more than OTC derivatives.
Right, derivatives.
Right. I can't even pronounce it properly right now. But yes, please continue.
There are different risks facing those businesses. They're dealing with different types of clients, different products. To try and apply a one-size-fits-all approach, I think, just denies those differences.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you, Alicia. I guess, you know, trying to simplify what is an incredibly complex industry, sometimes I say to people, look, please give up. There's complexity there for a reason, and we need smart people to work out smart solutions and not dumb it down. I'm sometimes bemused and I'm quizzical when people are trying to say we need to simplify stuff, when what you're dealing with, you know, I've seen options traders, for example, as an example, selling software that I've considered myself a reasonably intelligent guy, and I did good quality maths at school, and I'm bamboozled by some of the stuff they're coming out with. And they're saying to people, hey, don't worry, run this trading program and we're going to make you rich. And I'm sitting there going, I have so many problems with what you guys are doing. And I mean, they walk through your door and I guess they're convinced, aren't they?
Always. Always.
So how do you take them down off? And I'm going to bring into this discussion now about technology, because I am a technologist. I come from a software background. I was in telephony back in the day when we still used to pick things up off a cradle and have dial tone. Remember those? No, you probably don't. But yes, the dinosaur in me is coming out big time. But look, crypto is something that's near and dear to my heart, because I actually attended a blockchain presentation 10 years ago. And so I understand the underlying technology. What I don't understand is Bitcoin. I understand it's big speculative. And I said, and on my show, I actually referred to Bitcoin as the tulip index. So, and so when people ask me, what do you mean tulips? And I just say, just Google or internet search tulips in 1637 or 1634, I think it is, and read. Okay. And that happened, you know, we're talking almost 400 years ago, a speculative bubble happened in Holland. Good reading, ladies and gentlemen, good reading. And that's my equivalence, I guess, with Bitcoin. So my question to you, Alicia, sorry if it's a bit long-winded, but are we keeping up with tech at this point in time?
Look, I think ASIC is doing what it can with the resources that it has. But essentially, the changes which occur with technology, they happen so quickly. Mm. So for ASIC to keep up with new products, different services, and create regulation and guidance around that, there's, you know, for ASIC, there's a process of consultation, time for submissions, ASIC's review of those submissions from industry, and then releasing final guidance. None of that's a quick process. By the time they get out all of that, the technology could have moved on. So I think it's a tricky thing for ASIC to try and keep up with technology. In saying that, they do have an innovation hub. They do have a regulatory sandbox. And they're two ways that ASIC is trying to support innovation and actually recognise innovative products and services. The efficacy of those methods is up for debate, I would say. So, for instance, the enhanced regulatory sandbox, it's a process by which businesses can test certain innovative financial services without needing to hold an AFSL or a credit license first.
Oh, right.
So it's a great initiative, but there are really strict eligibility requirements. So applicants have to pass a net public benefit test. So the proposed service needs to actually address a current problem in the market and create a public benefit. And they also need to pass an innovation test, meaning that the applicant needs to explain why their service or product is different to what's already on the market. And the recent data from ASIC around this sandbox is that since September 2020, only 12 applicants have been accepted into the sandbox. So you're sort of looking at data that's not great, considering how many different ideas and products are out there in the market. So it's certainly an option. The sandbox is a good option, but if you can get past the eligibility requirements, you might be accepted in if you're lucky.
I guess it's an interesting facet that you raise, Alicia. I did my master's degree in public management, so I studied legislation. I studied public policy back in the day, and so my degree is almost 30 years old now. But when I did my master's, when you study how legislation comes together, the process that you've just described is not foreign to me, and it's necessary because when you draft legislation, the old bugbear of unintended consequences is something that people find out about to their demise when people rush legislation. And this is where, you know, good governance sometimes gets put aside for expedience. And so what you've described to me sounds perfectly logical, but unfortunately it also sounds like they've done that because they need to restrict the number of people coming through because of resource issues and funding. But also, I guess, the ability to be able to process this as quickly as they can. And so moving on, I guess when we're talking technology in the fin services area, it's really difficult to not talk about crypto and also non-fungible tokens, NFTs. And I'll be quite controversial. I guess I ask you the question directly. Should we be regulating crypto and NFTs in the Australian market?
I think yes.
So do I, by the way. So do I. And it's a simple answer to a very complex question because right now, far too many people, I keep reading the stats just from a pure consumer level. And when you go to the Murdoch papers or to even the independents that are out there today, raw numbers are suggesting that over 25 to close to 40% of people under 30 have invested money in crypto. That's huge. That is an enormous number of people that have put, be it $5, $20, $1,000 or more dollars into something that is not regulated. And every week on my show, I actually call out the Bitcoin price. I actually call it out and say, here we are. And you know, just recently it hit $66,000 a Bitcoin last year. It's under $20,000. Everybody loves to talk the winners, but how many people come out there and go, hey, actually, I've just lost 75% of my portfolio? And that's where people then start asking questions, well, maybe we do need to regulate. Nobody wants a winning market to be regulated. They only want it regulated when they're losing. Isn't that right?
Very true.
And so I guess I'm curious, in your travels, have you come across people walking into your boardroom talking about NFTs, non-fungible tokens?
On the odd occasion, yes. Yes.
Did you understand them?
I would say I understood them at a very basic level.
Because I want to ask you the question because, again, being a lawyer – You being a lawyer, I've read about NFTs. I've got a very, very outspoken daughter who's almost 28 that has told me everything about NFTs and that they're the scourge of the planet and that they're going to bring everybody down. But I sit there and try and understand the concepts where somebody digitally has a piece of something that says, you know, I've got number one. And I sit there and go, yeah, but I can make gazillion copies on a hard drive. I have no idea why is there value in that. And so the artist in my wife comes and steps forward and says, well, there is, because, you know, you can reproduce a Mona Lisa, but the only one that's really worth the gazillion dollars is the original. And I sit there and I'm scratching my head. Is this the kind of logic they put to you when they're talking about their pitch?
Yeah, it's very similar. And I have to say my understanding sort of stops at the very basic level of trying to understand what these are. And I do not understand the mathematics behind it, that's for sure.
I often wonder whether NFTs really lends credence to that wonderful idiom that a fool and their money are easily parted. And remembering that an NFT recently, you know, sold for $250,000 and then sort of 6 months later was worth $20. And notwithstanding, ladies and gentlemen, I might remind you that Rupert Murdoch back in the day paid over $270 million at the time for the first social network, and the name escapes me right now, MySpace. That's right, MySpace.
Yeah.
He paid $270 million for MySpace and then flogged it off 5 years later for a fraction of that, because something called Facebook, was it? Was that? Yeah, Facebook, that's right. Facebook came along and totally blindsided them and took them out big time. I guess I look at that and sort of go, wow, okay. So, look, let's move on. Given that you and I are in the industry, one of the things that we're big on Dollars and Making Sense is about education. And so I guess from your perspective, where do you suggest that an everyday person starts to look when they're trying to go down this journey of enlightening themselves financially?
I think ASIC's Money Smart website has a lot of commentary, and it's in plain English, which is helpful.
It's amazing.
And it includes a lot of not just definitions, but simple explanations and examples of how financial products work, how they are structured, and how they might work out in practice, in a practical example. So that can be really helpful for the everyday person to try and get their head around some of the more complex products that are in the market. ASIC's website in general as well, so not their Money Smart website, their ordinary website, has a lot of information for consumers. So there's a lot of information for financial industry players, but there's also a section for consumers that talks about how ASIC regulates certain industries, particularly focusing on superannuation, insurance, financial advice, and banking, and also how to check if a company is licensed and how to complain about a financial service provider. So those types of things, quite important, especially checking if a company is licensed and how they're regulated, who the regulator is. Not everyone just comes under ASIC. Some are also regulated by APRA. So it's important to have that information accessible to you.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, just to be clear, some of those APRA-regulated organisations include industry super funds and major super funds. So these aren't small potatoes. And when you think about super today, $3.3 trillion. They are big numbers. And so when Paul Keating started the system back up in the 90s, that was his vision, that, you know, we would be funding our own retirement. Yet we still see today, and the reason we need good regulation is that, you know, there are many interesting innovations happening to plunder this big treasure trove of $3.3 trillion. And so I guess, look, Alicia, you've pointed to one of the sources that I always like to point people to, and Money Smart being that it is government, so the word hopefully is true. I'm wondering, again, a personal opinion, do you think that the Money Smart people maybe need to liven it up and maybe do something on TikTok themselves? I'm just curious. No, given that there are people out there that just simply rip off their stuff, and it's fine. I rip their stuff off all the time, but I give notice. I say, this is from Money Smart. I give the proper acknowledgement. But do you think they should do some stuff for TikTok and maybe engage some young people under 30 to do these kind of things?
Absolutely. I think that would be fascinating. You know, that's where people are getting their information, their financial information. So, yeah, I mean, ASIC does education in and around schools, but that sort of 20, 30-somethings, they're looking at TikTok, they're looking at social media. I would, yeah, absolutely think it would be great.
I'd be there on the side. I mean, I don't touch TikTok, not interested, but I'd be there waving a big flag, and same with Insta. Not interested, but I'd be there saying, ASIC, get in there, get Money Smart to start putting content on these, because people are ripping your stuff off and sending people the wrong way, because then that's where these marketing affiliations and that's where it all goes off the rails. But look, Alicia, I'd like to thank you. We're just about out of time today. I'd like to really thank you for coming on the radio show. It's your first time. I know there was a little bit of reticence there, and, you know, I see the big smile, ladies and gentlemen. You can't see it, but I can see this wonderfully big smile, and I'm really pleased that you've come on board for the show. I'd like to have you back again, and we'll talk again some specifics. I'd like to maybe delve a little bit more into the tech and the innovation area, but around compliance and regulatory can get a bit dry at times, but I think we've done okay today. So thank you so kindly for your time and your contribution. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. And this is Ray Trevison from OTG Capital signing off. And Alicia, thank you very kindly from Sophie Grace. And until next time, adios.
Thanks for listening to Dollars and Making Sense, a weekly program about finance, money and investing. The views, comments and opinions aired during our program should not be construed or viewed as financial advice. Any commentary is general advice only and does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. You should consider whether the advice is suitable for you and your personal circumstances. If in doubt, you should contact an authorised licensed financial planner.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this week's edition of The Market Wrap. And let's look at the indices. And the first one we're looking at right now is the All Ordinaries. It had a pretty ordinary week, I've got to say. And so with a lot of the statements that are coming out and reviews of what's going on, there was, a negative view of the world with interest rates and the pressures on supply chains and the like had a negative impact on stock market valuations. Similarly, the Dow Jones really plummeted from the height of 34,000 down to below and close to 31,000. So that's quite a drop. That's close to 10% that they've had in that preceding week. And so it's not been a good week, I guess, if you're holding on to shares. Fascinatingly, though, gold has had a reasonably interesting time and has bounced a little bit back off its cellar dwelling. But again, I keep on pointing out to people that want to listen, we are in a situation where gold has done not a lot in the last 10 years, but people still like investing in it anyway. Bitcoin, that's having a bad time as well. We're looking at Bitcoin and again that cryptocurrency that's really come off the top of 66,000 and is still bottom dwelling, and it's bottom dwelling even more now below 20,000, and this week it's roughly around $19,500 per Bitcoin, climbing up a little bit, but still not great if you've been in and you bought at the peak. Not fabulous at all. Now the dollar is having an interesting time as well, and for those of you that necessarily follow currencies in a way, most of you may or may not be aware, but the pound at the moment is being absolutely hammered because of Brexit and the horrendous inflation that the Brits are going through. Their dollar is down, their pound is down around $1.15, and they're talking about it going to parity with the US dollar soon. And they are just about to announce a new prime minister. The Tories have voted, and I guess the smart money is on Liz Truss. I think it was a choice of dumb or even dumber between her and Rishi Sunak. I'm really not sure when you're ousting Boris Johnson and they're your choices. My word, it's not pleasant reading. Anyway, let's keep going on to my readings for the week. Hopes are diminishing that global inflation will be easing as prices for key raw materials had fallen in recent weeks. But again, the readings that I'm listening to and watching and reading, ladies and gentlemen, keep on telling me that peak inflation has passed and that we're going to see some easing, I guess, in the next sort of months or so. I was at a recent shareholders association meeting where pretty well everyone around the room, and these are seasoned investors that invest, you know, quite regularly, were rather down on the market. I'm not quite so sure at this point in time. The economists that I read and trust are sort of suggesting that, you know, we're not having a good time of it. Nobody doubts that. But I think that the necessary gloom and doom looking into the future is not there. And I guess one of the things as well that gives me a strong amount of confidence is that we have an incredibly smart person now in charge of the Treasury levers. And like Labor or not, you've got somebody that has a PhD now that is in charge of Treasury, and I have a lot more comfort in somebody pulling the levers of power in that Treasury portfolio than I did the previous holders of those portfolios. Anyway, we move on.
Federal Reserve Chair Powell commented this week that US interest rates are going to go higher. And certainly my readings tell me that later on today, at the time of this recording, we are going to see another 50 basis points rise here in Australia. I still think we're in tune for maybe another 25 or 50 after that, and then that will do. I don't think the RBA is going to go too much further. Mortgage stress will be too much of a factor, and I think that people will, I think, grit their teeth, but I don't think there's going to be too many more interest rates rising. I guess the big message right now is soaring energy prices, a real political problem for many governments. And I see that a number of European jurisdictions now are coming out and legislating windfall tax profits against these profits. Now, how much money have these energy companies made in all this time? I actually found something that said something about that. It's in the tune of $2 trillion in addition to what they normally make. And let me tell you, they normally make a lot of money anyway, but we're talking about an additional $2 trillion that these energy companies have made in the past, year or so. Here we are. The International Energy Agency estimates that energy suppliers have won an additional $2 trillion US dollars windfall from soaring prices this year alone, doubling their income. So I know they're not popular when people talk taxes, but gee, when you think about how much foreign money comes out of Australia into foreign hands from energy prices, which are purely gouging, ladies and gentlemen, there is no energy shortage here in this part of the planet. We've got plenty, and we've got plenty of sunshine. We've got plenty of ways of generating energy, yet we are paying through the nose. And I'm one, I guess, a big one that keeps on asking why we privatized infrastructure that we necessarily didn't have to privatize. I don't know. Let's keep moving on. Now, last week we had the Jobs Summit, and I found some rather interesting discussions. The income of migrants is going to increase quite substantially to close to 200,000. I think that's a good thing. I also see that Treasurer Chalmers is looking at the regions and what they may do to also put more funding into the infrastructure-starved areas that they're looking at. Prime Minister Albanese is also looking at the increased health and education funding and greater use of renewables. So get used to that, I guess, that statement. And not just, government talking about renewables, but also the RBA is warning businesses should start planning for more and more around climate change. And I keep on saying this over and over. Forget the conspiracy theorists about whether you do or don't believe climate change. Read the Insurance Council of Australia and ask yourself, why are they now coming in and saying to people, guess what, we're not going to insure your flood prone houses anymore, and we're not going to insure businesses that don't take mediating steps against climate change. Now, they are not conspiracy theorists. They are cold, hard business people that are making a business decision, and they know, they read the same scientific data that 98% of the scientists around the world that contribute to the IPCC see and are looking at, and the glaciers that are melting and all the flooding that's occurring and everything else that's occurring on the planet. And they're going, you know what? Things aren't the way they used to be. So, last piece I'll leave you with. Australians are saving heaps into super. Wow. The latest figures from the regulator APRA shows that the total contributions to super jumped 88% to $146 billion during the 22 financial year, but withdrawals fell only 9.5%. So that means that the big treasure chest is still growing and Australians are busy building retirement balances. Thanks for listening in this week, ladies and gentlemen. And until next week, from Dollars and Making Sense, it's adios.